And we could go on and on with the wars the U.S. government has waged, even in the face of popular opposition. The Philippines at the end of the turn of the century, where the U.S. military went in and not only, you know, after defeating the Spanish, took over the Philippines and denied the people independence, but slaughtered and mutilated and committed brutal atrocities against hundreds of thousands of Philippine people. And there was massive opposition to that war. Mark Twain was one of the people who opposed it, among other prominent people. Even World War II, there was a lot of opposition, and in fact, Roosevelt had to develop a whole program to more or less force the Japanese into attacking the U.S., and then he sat by knowingly while the attack on Pearl Harbor happened in order to have the pretext for then pushing the U.S. into the war. And maybe there are some echoes of that these days. There's a whole book by a guy named Robert Stinnett called Day of Deceit, which catalogs and very, very carefully documents that Roosevelt knew very well that the attack on Pearl Harbor was coming and that he wanted it to come in order to be able to overcome popular opposition to that war. And we have Vietnam and now Iraq and on and on. None of these things was carried out without the military of the U.S., obviously, and without repression of people in this country who opposed those wars. This is the workings of a dictatorship. Even in order to get basic things like unions in this country, took a bloody battle of decades. People died in the dozens and hundreds, and many more were jailed, families broken up as a result of these struggles. And we could go on and on up to the present or more recent times, the experience of the 1960s and early 70s. Massive, brutal, and murderous repression of mass urban rebellions. From L.A. in 1965, the Watts Rebellion, to Detroit and Newark in 67, and over 100 cities after Martin Luther King was assassinated in 1968. And what did they do? Oh, well, who can blame the people for rising up? After all, we've brutally oppressed them for centuries now, so we should do something to change this. No, they sent in the army to brutally repress this, to murder people. In Detroit in 1967, they rounded up people taking part in the rebellion, took them to a place called the Algiers Motel, and executed them on the spot. This is the workings of a dictatorship keeping in power a class that is the representatives of a system. We could go on and on. What happened to the Black Panther Party? Several dozen of its members murdered. Most notoriously, Fred Hampton, along with Mark Clark, in Chicago in 1969, shot in his bed in the middle of the night. And there was a real lesson, too, in Fred Hampton's murder. Because not only did they murder him, but as they always do, immediately the whole media apparatus went into full swing, proclaiming that this was an act of self-defense by the police who'd been viciously fired upon by the Panthers, which was a complete lie, but every media repeated it. Every medium repeated it. And the Panthers did something very smart. They organized tours and they took people to the site where this occurred and showed people that these markings that the media and the police were claiming were bullet holes of bullets going out were in fact nail holes, and that all the markings of bullets were all coming in from the outside. And only after years of struggle did people who were involved in that even get any kind of redress. And never did the media do any kind of self-criticism for the role that it played, because they're part of the apparatus too. And there was Attica, the brutal murder of dozens of prisoners, but also guards that the prisoners were holding hostage in order to put down that rebellion. There was Kent State and Jackson State, where students, black and white, were murdered for protesting the Vietnam War. And we could go on and on. There was a program, counterintelligence program, known as COINTELPRO for short, which was aimed at targeting and destroying, overtly, explicitly, right out in the open, aimed at targeting and destroying radical and revolutionary and oppositional movements and organizations. And this was part of what was directed against the Black Panther Party, as well as many others. And they did all kinds of vicious things. Besides murdering people, there was an actress, Jean Seberg, for example, and they spread a rumor when she got pregnant that her baby was a baby of one of the Black Panthers and so on. I don't know if it was or not, but they launched a whole campaign to discredit her in some way, and she ended up committing suicide. These are the small and big things of the way this dictatorship operates. And the point through all this is whenever they perceive a threat of whatever kind, and especially from mass popular resistance and rebellion, this is what they do. We could look again more recently at the L.A. Rebellion in 1992. What did they do there? Now, you know, why did that rebellion happen? It's interesting to think about that, and it illustrates the point I'm making. Rodney King was beaten viciously in 1991, and it was videotaped, as we all know. But that's not when the rebellion broke out, even though it would have been perfectly justified if it had. What happened was there was a legal proceeding that was initiated. They took the trial and they moved it to Ronald Reagan land, Simi Valley, where a lot of cops live. They found a jury that would acquit the cops, given the right presentation of the case. They found a judge, which was very easy to do, who would make the right presentation. And then they did what they only do when cops are the ones on trial, as rarely happens. The prosecutors all of a sudden didn't know the fuck how to prosecute. I know a lot of people have told me, man, if I ever have another case, I want to have those prosecutors prosecuting like that on my case. Because they deliberately messed up the case and presented it in terms that were just a fat gift for the defense. And you put all those factors together and there was an acquittal. And that's when you got the rebellion. Because before that, youth from the ghettos and the barrios were going around taunting the police. Saying, what are you going right up in their face? And what are you going to do now? We got the videotape now. Go ahead, beat me. Go ahead, beat me. We're going to videotape it again. And what were they saying? They were saying, we finally got the proof. This goes on over and over and over again endlessly, but nobody wants to believe us. And now they got to believe us. Now we got the proof. And then when they came out with the acquittal, they said, these motherfuckers don't give a fuck. And everything went up. And what happened? They say, oh, well, that's perfectly understandable. Anybody who has any sense of justice would be outraged. No, they sent in the police and the army. Because that's what they do. That's the exercise of dictatorship over the people who are subjected to this kind of treatment day in, day out. And here I'm not going to even talk about repression directed against our party and its leadership. But all this brings us back to a fundamental question. What is, after all, a dictatorship? We're always taught and conditioned to think that, you know, through the media and the popular culture and everything, the educational system, that a dictatorship is ruled by a few people, and in particular by one power-mad, crazed individual. In the image you could think of back in the 50s, for example, Khrushchev, speaking at the UN, took off his shoe and was pounding his shoe on the podium of the UN, saying to the U.S., we will bury you. And of course, this was completely misrepresented in the U.S. media. What Khrushchev was actually talking about, because he'd given up on revolution, what he was actually talking about is, we're going to produce more refrigerators, washing machines, and things like that, and we're going to prove that we're economically better than you, and then you'll be done for. But this was portrayed as a madman. What kind of person goes to the UN and pounds his shoe on the table? Or there's the movie that many people have seen. Charlie Chaplin is a great dictator, got the globe dressed up like Hitler, dancing around with the globe. Well, there's some truth in some aspects of this, but it's not the essence of it. Dictatorship is not the rule by a small clique of crazy people or power-mad individuals. In one form or another, dictatorship, in essence, is ruled by a class. It's its domination of political power. And in a concentrated way, it's monopoly of armed force, and in particular, so-called legitimate armed force. Now let's go back to the Rodney King thing or so many cases like that. What was the verdict there? What's the phrase you always hear? Justifiable homicide. The police acted out of the need to carry out their duty, so they had a legitimate fear of the person that they killed, so it's justifiable homicide. That reflects the fact that they have a monopoly of armed force and a monopoly of so-called legitimate armed force, which is an essential characteristic of a dictatorship of any kind. Let's turn this situation around. Now, just to be clear, I'm not advocating anything. I'm just drawing an illustration here. Let's go back to the story of Amadou Diallo, walking down the street in New York, accosted by these police in a threatening manner, and shot down by them. Let us roll the tape back and say that at the point when they begin to accost him, he suddenly realized that he was in grave danger, which he was, from these police, and acting out of a legitimate fear of the danger of being killed by this police, he immediately ran into his house, came back out with a hunting rifle, and blew them away. That would not be a judge justifiable homicide, even though while they did not, he had a perfectly legitimate fear of violence directed against him and even murder by those police. Why could that not be declared justifiable homicide? Because the ruling class, as represented in this case by the police and its other armed forces, have a monopoly of armed force and in particular legitimate armed force in the society. That's a defining feature of a dictatorship. Look at the role of American democracy in the international dimension for a minute. In 1953, they didn't like a popularly elected government in Iran, headed by a man named Mossadegh. So they worked through the CIA and with the military and ousted it, and then brought a reign of terror with the Shah of Iran, whom they put on the throne, for decades. Or in Guatemala in 1954, there was a government headed by a man named Arbenz, who was also popularly elected. They didn't like that government either. It was instituting reforms. So they accused it of being the communist stooges and went in and did the same thing, overthrew it and instituted a reign of terror for decades in Guatemala of unspeakable terms. And you can go down the list. Chile in 1973, the same thing. Or Indonesia in 1965. In 1965, Indonesia had one of the most powerful, or at least one of the largest, communist parties in the world. Only the party in the Soviet Union and China was larger. It had several million members and supporters. But it made the fatal mistake of thinking that it could democratically, and through being elected to parliament and other ways, kind of work its way into a position where it could bring power in, bring socialism in peacefully. And it had a lot of influence in the government of Sukarno at that time and in the society at large. And in recognition of that, the U.S. through the CIA once again pulled off a coup and carried out a massacre of the communists. Somewhere between 500,000 and 1,000,000 people were killed in the space of a few months in Indonesia, murdered by the military working with the CIA, which is now they finally acknowledged. It was so horrendous that in the rivers around the capital city of Jakarta in Indonesia, the bodies from these massacres were piled up so much that the rivers became clogged. And it didn't bother them that the Sukarno government was a popular government in Indonesia or that the Allende government in Chile was a popularly elected government. It went against their interests, so they used their instruments of armed force to get rid of those governments, even reformist governments, that they regarded as being against their interests. When I was going to school at Cal in the 60s, I had a roommate from India. His name was Siddhartha Berman. My Jewish friend used to joke with him and say, "Oh, nice Jewish boy, Sid Berman." But his name was actually Siddhartha Berman. And he came from the ruling classes in India, from the bourgeoisie. His father was the owner of a big pharmaceutical company. And this was the 60s, so we worked on him and worked on him as we started getting more radical. The most we could do was turn him into a hippie. We never actually got him. We never actually got him any farther than that. But he used to tell us, his family lived in Calcutta. And he would get up in the morning and walk from his home to his father's pharmaceutical company. And he would tell us how every morning he would step over many bodies of people who died the night before on the streets of Calcutta, died of exposure, starvation, and disease every day. And yet, what are we always told about India? It's the world's largest democracy. People are brutally oppressed and exploited, tortured by the police if they rebel, have their eyes poked out by hot metal, among other tortures, routinely in India if people rebel. Women are terribly oppressed, sometimes burned when they're born because they're not considered valuable enough. But the people can vote, so it's the world's largest democracy. Now let's go a little farther and talk about the role of elections in a country and in a world dominated by imperialism, in particular U.S. imperialism. I was reading a book on lynching, and it was discussing how Sometimes a lynch mob would just grab the first black person, usually a black man that they could find, and lynch him if something happened to infuriate them. Or they heard a rumor that something had happened that infuriated them. But on some occasions, rather than just doing it that way, they would allow the court proceeding to go on, but they would fill the courtroom armed to the teeth, waiting for the verdict to be announced. Now, under those circumstances, there was only one verdict that was possible. And of course, it was always guilty. And then an official lynching was carried out instead of an unofficial one. And this reminds me of elections under the gun of imperialism. Think, for example, of Nicaragua. The Sandinistas were not a Marxist-Leninist Maoist force. There were a lot of problems with their program, with their ideology and outlook. They tried to combine some armed struggle with negotiations with bourgeois forces. They had a mixed bag government, but even that was too much for the U.S., and it launched this whole vicious counter-revolutionary war with the Contras and everything else, bombing the harbors. It was even condemned by the World Court, which made absolutely no difference to the U.S. All under the kindly Ronald Reagan, by the way. And they kept pressuring the Nicaraguan government to have elections. So finally they had an election, which by most standards was certainly more fair than the election in 2000 in the U.S. And the Sandinistas won that election. So then the U.S. said, that's no good, and they gave more aid to the Contras and did more things to brutalize the people in Nicaragua, blowing up and destroying health clinics and cooperative farms and so on. And then they insisted once again that they have an election because they didn't like the outcome of the previous one. So finally the Sandinistas gave in and had an election. And in effect, the U.S., with its guns trained on Nicaragua and all its military arsenal, said, you can vote for whomever you want. If you vote for these people we like, we'll ease up, we'll give you aid, we'll take the pressure away. Guess what will happen if you vote for the Sandinistas? Well, the Sandinistas, not surprisingly, lost the election. Because a lot of the middle forces, those who weren't firmly committed to the revolution but also weren't against it, were swayed by that, understandably. And I mentioned the kindly Ronald Reagan. Recently, we've had all this bullshit about Reagan going on and droning on and on. So I can't help it. I have to say a few words about Ronald Reagan. You know, he's been repackaged as this avuncular, this uncle-like figure who's so kindly and a man of peace and goodwill. And, you know, and of course, a devout religious man. Never mind that Nancy was all into the horoscopes and astrology and all the rest of that. But what about Ronald Reagan? Let's get our memories back. You remember Ronald Reagan and during his presidency? At one point he got on while he was making a speech and supposedly didn't know he was on the air and made a joke. World War III is starting. We begin bombing in 5 minutes. And this was during a time when Reagan, at the head of the U.S. government, was taking the world to the brink of actual nuclear war as part of the confrontation to push back gains that the Soviet Union had made in various parts, particularly of the Third World, in the aftermath of the U.S. defeat in Vietnam. He was literally pushing the world to the brink of nuclear war during the 1980s. And then he makes a joke. World War III has started. We begin bombing in 5 minutes. Who can find that funny? Only the most twisted and perverted people who identify completely with this system of exploitation and plunder called imperialism. Or look at Central America. I mentioned the coup in Guatemala in 1954. Under the Reagan administration in particular, aid was given to these brutal military dictatorships that viciously oppressed and slaughtered the people in the thousands and tens of thousands. One particular leader of the so-called leader of the government of Guatemala, named Rios Montt, was a born-again evangelical Christian butcher. He was a particular favorite, not only of Reagan, but of Pat Robertson and Jerry Falwell, who openly championed his cause and prayed for God to help him in his great crusade. And under Rios Montt and these other brutal dictators, kept in power and backed and armed by the U.S., I wrote about this in the book, Democracy, Can't We Do Better Than That? And as I pointed out, even there I was not really able to capture the full horror of this. They would go into village after village after village line up all the people, especially where they thought there was guerrilla activity going on to oppose the government, kill off all the men, rape all the women, and then take the babies and bash their heads in. Perhaps they were inspired, particularly under Rios Montt, by the passage in the Bible that call for bashing in the heads of babies in the enemy camp. But this is what was done under the great, avuncular, kindly, peace-loving Ronald Reagan. This is another illustration of the way in which this world is ruled by military force and violence, of a ruling class that lives by, thrives on, and can only exist on the basis of brutally exploiting and oppressing people in their millions and even billions. Or we hear a lot these days, from time to time, about the horror of what happened in Rwanda during the 1990s. And it was a real horror, partly by the instigation of the French, as well as the U.S. and other imperialists. There was a mass slaughter that was carried out. Hundreds of thousands of people were brutally killed in a short period of time. It was a real horror, and now the imperialists are wringing their hands. Why didn't we intervene to prevent this? But that was like a paroxysm, a spasm of violence that lasted a few months in a very concentrated way. But in the 1980s in Africa, and in particular in Mozambique, the U.S. put together and armed and backed a group called RENAMO, which not just for a few months, and not in a spasm of violent outburst, but in a systematic way went about mutilating as well as murdering people. In the hundreds of thousands, and they would mutilate people and kill them, then they would go into the hospital where the survivors were and mutilate and kill more on a systematic, regular basis. And Ronald Reagan declared them great freedom fighters. And before moving on, there's one more thing I want to say about Reagan that might seem like a small thing, but really captures something very big and essential. Some of you may remember back in the 1970s, there was a group called the Symbionese Liberation Army, the SLA, and they weren't very good. Their ideology was not good. Their political program was not good. Their tactics were not right, etc., etc. But in any case, they kidnapped Patty Hearst, heir to the Hearst family fortune in California. And one of the demands they made was that the Hearst family finance and organize distribution of food to poor people who couldn't afford food. And the Hearst family agreed. And in this context, Ronald Reagan came out and said, I hope there's an outbreak of botulism, deadly food poisoning. Now, by what possible measure or standard could a person with a shred of decency, whatever you thought about the SLA, how could any person with a shred of decency wish an outbreak of deadly food poisoning on poor people who are being given food because they can't afford it? And if they want to tell us that's a joke, what kind of people, what class of people could find that funny? Well, this is a class of people we're dealing with, and their rule in the world is a rule by force and violence, and their rule in the U.S. is a rule backed up by force and violence. It is a dictatorship. We can get an idea of their model of democracy by what they're doing in Iraq. They invade the country, occupy it, kill thousands of people, brutally suppress any resistance, appoint a government, and then declare that democracy is beginning to flower. So in moving on, I want to quote something that Dolly referred to earlier in the introduction. An important point that I made in the book, Democracy, Can't We Do Better Than That? To state it in a single sentence, in capitalist society, elections are controlled by the bourgeoisie, are not the means through which basic decisions are made in any case, and are really for the primary purpose of legitimizing the system and the policies and actions of the ruling class, giving them the mantle of a popular mandate and a means of channeling, confining, and controlling the political activity of the masses of people. And all of what I've been talking about is an illustration of that. And one of the things that results from this is that they get a popular mandate to the degree that people accept this as a legitimate decision-making process. And then they can turn around and blame the people for everything they do. Well, the people voted for it. Our job is to represent the will and interests of the people, so we have to do these things. And you even hear ridiculous comments like, If you don't vote, then you can't complain about what happens. Really. This is analogous to, let's say you're out in the street, and instead of just being robbed by one person, you had two gangs came up to you. And they say, we're going to rob and brutalize you and leave you bloody here, but you can vote on which one you want to do it. And if you don't vote, you have no right to complain about what we did. But the even more profound point and underlying point here is that the elections and the politicians and their actual role in the political process cannot help but function in the way that they do in accordance with the needs and dictates of the capitalist system. If politicians seek to act in a way that is fundamentally out of sync with the way that the underlying economic system functions, they will either be crushed or they will create so much chaos that the system will grind to a halt. And unless you want to see the whole system gone, you're not going to do that. And there are people with power who are not going to let you do it if you try to work within their mechanisms. Let's take a very simple example. Go back to the thing about people without decent food or health care. Let's focus on the question of food. What if you tried to pass a law that no one in this country should be hungry, and everyone who needed food could have it? And therefore, a logical extension of that is, if you didn't have food, you could go into a supermarket and take it, because you had an overarching right, a fundamental right to be able to eat. Such a thing is impossible in this system, because things are not produced because people need them or in accordance with people's needs. They're produced to make profit for those who control the production. And it's not profitable to set things up so that everybody can eat decently in a society and have enough food or medical care or decent housing. And if you tried to make a law like that, all of a sudden you'd have people acting on it. Millions of people would just go into the grocery stores and start taking food. And the whole thing would grind to a halt and come unraveled. And this is just a small example of the bigger point that the politicians fundamentally have to act in accordance with the needs and dictates and the underlying dynamics of this system. And if they don't, they will be ground up and spit out, or they'll be co-opted, one or the other. So all this gets us then, to the basic question of the workings of this system and what to do about it. It is not simply a matter of changing leaders. Even the capitalists have to act in fundamental accordance with the interests and dynamics of their own system. Look, for example, at Ted Turner, who started CNN, had billions of dollars invested in it. It merged with Time Warner on an even bigger scale, even more billions of dollars, and he got shoved out, big as he was. Or look what happened to poor old Kmart. Got shoved out by Walmart. Or look at all these companies that say, well, look, if we don't go to all these countries like Indonesia or, shame of shames, Vietnam, or Pakistan or Haiti or Guatemala, if we don't go and pay low wages there, we're going to be beaten out by some other corporation in the U.S. or somewhere else who does do that. And in a fundamental sense, as vicious as that is, it's the truth. Within the confines of this system. So changing individuals at the top of the system cannot change this. It is not a solution. So this leads us to the question, what is the fundamental solution? What is the actual and essential alternative? Revolution is the real alternative and the fundamental solution. Revolution is necessary and is also possible in the world today, even given what we must very squarely recognize is the great strength of U.S. imperialism and its role in the world. And revolution is possible under the right circumstances and with the right preparation in the U.S. itself, right here in the belly of the beast. The global system of imperialism in which the ruling class of the U.S. holds the top dog position thrives by brutally exploiting and plundering literally millions and billions of people and whole countries all over the world, as well as devastating the environment and putting in jeopardy the future of humanity. This is bound to and does call forth resistance of many different kinds from people all over the globe and within the U.S. itself. And these imperialists, as much strength as they really do have, and as much as they have a massive arsenal of destructive power, cannot be everywhere at once, putting down every form of rebellion and resistance against them, and they can and do get overextended or bogged down in their moves to impose their will and their domination in many different parts of the world. And we can see this playing out right before us today, even if not yet on the scale it needs to be. We can see it in Iraq. Not only was there mass protest and rebellion in advance of the war, but they're having real trouble stabilizing their rule right now in Iraq itself. More than a year after Bush arrogantly declared, dressed up in his pilot's, probably the only time he actually was flying, dressed up in his pilot suit proclaiming mission accomplished. And in the world today, there are much more inspiring examples than Iraq. There is the Revolutionary People's War being waged in Nepal, where against a much more powerful military force to begin with, the Maoist party there has led millions of peasants to rise up in arms and to actually liberate, in terms of territory, more than three quarters of the country and to come very close to the threshold of actually the final battle for power. But we have to take stock of the realities of the way the world is, as our comrades in Nepal are very definitely doing. They've come to the threshold to where, if you were to isolate Nepal by itself, the question of the final battle for determining who would rule the whole country would be very close to being on the agenda. But Nepal does not exist in a world all unto itself. It exists in a larger world. It's right next to India, China. The Soviet Union is not that far away. And, of course, there's the U.S., which has already arrogantly declared through Colin Powell and others that they will not allow the Maoists to come to power. Even though no one can deny that the Maoist People's War in Nepal has massive support from the overwhelming majority of people in the country. It's shown every time they call a strike, they shut down the whole country. They've liberated large parts of the country. No one can actually deny it. Well, they can deny it, but no one can truthfully deny it. And it's getting harder and harder to deny it. And yet the U.S. arrogantly proclaims that it will not allow the people of Nepal to liberate themselves and take control of their own country. And, of course, this has to be taken very seriously, not only by the people leading that revolution in Nepal, our comrades there, but also by all of us who want to see people liberated in the world. And there's a special duty for us here, because this is our arrogant imperialist power, whether it works through India or with India or in some other way or directly intervenes at some point, which is determined to drown that in blood. And we have not an incidental, and we shouldn't have a passive role or attitude toward this. This is something we have to learn about, teach other people about, and mobilize people around. This is one of the most inspiring things going on in the world today. Even the bourgeois media, like newspapers in England, have had to admit that, for example, not only do the revolutionaries there, much against the stereotypes they portray, welcome in all the people who go trekking and climbing in Nepal, but they also go and approach them and give them political education about what's going on, and they ask them for donations. But even the media in England admitted nobody was ever put under pressure or felt under pressure if they didn't feel like donating money or supporting. Because our comrades there are carrying out a correct line of trying to win people over and win support on the basis of convincing them of the justice of their cause. And all kinds of tremendous things are already happening in the countryside. Women who are often either burned to death at birth or who, if they lived to a few years, in their young teenage years, often were forced to go to India to become prostitutes because the country is so poor, or who have to get up early in the morning and carry the whole burden of supporting the family, going out to collect water and firewood miles away and carrying it over the mountainous trails just to be able to feed the family. and whose lives were controlled by their fathers until they were married and arranged marriages to husbands who then controlled them. All that is changing in the countryside of Nepal. Women are not only breaking free of those chains, but a large number of them are taking part in the People's Army and being frontline fighters and leaders of that revolutionary cause. And we cannot allow the U.S. imperialists to declare and to act on the declaration that the people of Nepal cannot carry through and achieve complete liberation there. It is our responsibility to let people know about this, to expose what they're doing, and to support politically on a massive scale this struggle in Nepal, because it's carrying the future for all of us. And also, the more that we can build opposition and actually deliver a defeat to our own government, our own ruling class, and seeking to crush that revolution, so much farther we'll be ahead in our struggle against them. Now let me come back to the question of the U.S. And let's be very honest with each other. If you were to take a survey and ask people in this country and around the world, list the countries where it is most difficult to make revolution, the U.S. would win hands down. And for good reason. This is the center of their power. This is where they pay the most attention to keeping their grip most firmly on things, even while they reach their tentacles all over the world. This is where they have, on the basis of plundering the whole world, a powerful economy centered here. And they have, on the basis of that economy and that exploitation worldwide, a powerful military as well as a powerful political apparatus. So making revolution in this country is going to be far from easy. And if anyone were to stand before you and say they would be, you should immediately dismiss them. But let's look at it from the other side of the picture. From the side of the people who want to be free from this exploitation and oppression, and who've thought about revolution or some kind of radical change, we can see all the difficulties that go into that and everything that we're up against. And it is very daunting. It is awe-inspiring to look at this power. And especially if you don't understand the contradictions within it, it can seem overwhelming. But let's look at it for a minute from their side of the picture. Pat Buchanan, who's a reactionary, ran for president on the Republican primary as well as from the Reform Party candidacy, but is a major figure nonetheless within the ruling circles of the U.S., wrote a book called The Death of the West. And what he was complaining about was several things, but especially the fact that the U.S. is losing its character as a white European Christian country that is in danger in a few decades of no longer being even European origin in majority. And moreover, it's not just that we have immigrants coming into the country as we did in the past, but we have immigrants who don't want to be and can't be assimilated into the mainstream. People from the third world in particular. And he even goes into this whole tirade against homosexuals and women who want abortions because, in effect, they're committing racial autogenocide. Women who refuse to produce lots of babies for the white European population are contributing to the situation where we're going to lose the very center and of identity of this country as a white Christian nation. And this is a real concern of theirs, even though he poses it in extreme terms. There are tremendous numbers of people who are crucial to the functioning of this society. At the very base of it, carrying along a lot of the work that makes the society run, who are not easily integrated into and assimilated into the system and who are brutally exploited and oppressed. There's also something worth thinking about, which you can read in the writings of Alexis de Tocqueville, who was a Frenchman who came to the U.S. shortly after the American Revolution a couple of hundred years ago and wrote a book singing the praises of American democracy and all the new things it was bringing into the world. He noticed some interesting things. For example, he commented on the fact that there was this tremendous mania for money in the U.S. Rather timely observation. But this has been, as he pointed out, a part of the American character for a long time. But more importantly, much more importantly than that, He said, while praising American democracy and talking about its great future, he said there's one thing that could unravel the whole picture. And that's the situation of black people in America at that time in literal slavery. And although the conditions have changed over two centuries, the basic thing that he's pointing to has not changed. This is a people of tens of millions, many of them at the base of society being exploited as proletarians when they can find work, whose whole history is one of being brutally oppressed and exploited in this society time after time after time, even at major turning points after the Civil War, betrayed and brutally oppressed again. After the Civil Rights Movement broke out, betrayed and brutally oppressed again. A people in millions who, yes, go along in various ways trying to make it as people have to do living in a society, but whose fundamental alienation from and hatred for the whole way in which the system does things should never be underestimated, and is a tremendously powerful potential force for revolution, which has to be given conscious revolutionary and communist expression. It should never be overlooked or underestimated. And then they have a broader problem. Changes in the economy that are going on. The stability of jobs being undermined. The feeling that you could get a job and hold on to it and pass it on even to your kids, in effect, not there in the way it was before. And in addition, with the changes in the economy, there are many people who work in a sort of a global environment and are aware of it, and have a sort of, from their own more middle-class perspective, a sort of globalist orientation. And, by the way, people whose work is largely in the realm of ideas and who think, which is an unfavorable factor, especially these days, for the ruling class of this country. It's a significant thing, for example, that when in the build-up to the Iraq War, they ran out this line that basically we've been attacked, so anything we do is justified, in the aftermath of September 11th. A lot of people said that's not a just argument. American lives are not more important than the lives of people in other parts of the world. This was a widely discussed thing, and that's a new thing in this country, that people would actually say that. It's sort of a given of the ruling class that, of course, America is more important and, quote-unquote, American lives are more important than others. And all the rationalizations that the Bush regime put out to justify the war in Iraq were rejected by a lot of people as obviously fallacious, as obviously a pack of lies. And now everybody can see you have a regime in power that's proven liars. It isn't even open to dispute anymore. You can choose to ignore it, as some people do. You know, someone made the comment that living in America is a little bit like living in the house of Tony Soprano. You have some idea that the way you live and the goodies you have something to do with what he's doing out there. But you really don't want to know too much about what that is. And there are people like that in this country. There's no denying, and we have to do work to win even some of them over. But there are a lot of people who don't buy that. And right now, their form of resistance and rebellion is not on a revolutionary level, but it's extremely important, and it's going to grow if work is done correctly to bring it forward on a higher level. And in talking about revolution in this country, we should never forget the role of youth. I don't believe in romanticizing the youth, but I do believe in understanding and giving full expression to the important qualities of youth in changing the world, the way in which they're not so stuck in their ways and willing to change their mind and be open to new things and to challenge authority which is unjust and arbitrary and to rebel against things that are clearly oppressive. This is a tremendously important force, particularly among the most oppressed in society, but also much more broadly among broader strata, wider strata in this society. Now, all of this, of course, doesn't add up to a revolution in a vacuum. But if a number of different things come together, and if revolutionary work has been done in the correct way over a period of time, and through the ebbs and flows and the intensity and then the apparent relaxation, and then once again the intensity of contradictions and struggle, If, for example, you can imagine things like many different rebellions, not just isolated here in L.A. in 92 and in Cincinnati at the end of the 90s, but taking place like they did all at one time after the assassination of Martin Luther King. If you can imagine massive outpouring against another or yet another war that this government unleashes. And let's say the war goes even worse than the Iraq one does, and they suffer even more reverses and more disputes and struggle go on inside their own ranks. And it begins to spread to the military, who become disaffected, especially the rank and file soldiers, realizing, as happened in the Vietnam War, they were lied to about why they were sent to fight these wars. And sensing that these wars cannot be won in the way they were told they could be, quickly and with decisive force. If you put that together, and then you imagine some incident that causes a jolt throughout society coming from one place or another, then the question of revolution, even in this country, doesn't seem so impossible. And if you've had people uniting behind a revolutionary line, pushing and working in that direction, and bringing forward the youth, and bringing forward other oppressed, and building a broad united front of people to resist and rebel against the many injustices and outrages of this system, and bringing forward a revolutionary understanding in the midst of that, and increasingly to the fore of that, then the prospect of making a revolution doesn't seem so distant or impossible. Now, there are many challenges that have to be confronted in advancing toward revolution in this world and in this country, including great changes that have taken place in the world in the last number of years. I was talking to someone recently, and they criticized our party for not paying enough attention to some of these major changes in technology, like genetic engineering and things like that. Well, we have tried. We wrote something called Notes on Political Economy within the last few years, where we did try to analyze some of this. But I said to you, your criticism has some validity. We do need to understand this a lot more. And some of these major technological changes are going on, are causing major upheavals in the world. We have now reached the point where, for the first time in the history of the world, a majority of people live in or around urban areas. Tens of thousands of peasants, because of the working of the imperialist economy, are being driven out of the countryside, no longer able to live there, even under the previous horrendous forms of oppression and exploitation, forced into shanty towns and slums surrounding the cities. How to make revolution in countries after country after country where that's a phenomenon? How to make revolution in a world where this genetic engineering is radically changing agriculture? How to make a world revolution in a world where the changes in technology and the accompanying globalization are bringing about major changes economically, socially, politically, and ideologically? These are problems and obstacles and challenges that we have to take up, and it's in working through problems and challenges like this that a revolution can advance. But one thing that's important to keep in mind is that strategically, these changes in the world, including and driven by these changes in technology, are heightening and making more acute the basic contradictions of capitalism and imperialism. The fact that technology is at hand and exists in the world today to meet all the fundamental needs of the people all over the world, and yet half the world's population is trying to survive on $2 a day or less because all this technology is in the hands of a class that can only make use of it by exploiting and oppressing and impoverishing people. These contradictions are being heightened and made more acute. It is in working through this that revolution can be made. And this revolution leads to socialism. So here I want to get a bit into the question of democracy and dictatorship, not in this capitalist system, but in socialist society, and how this relates to the final goal of communism, since socialism is a transition to the final goal of communism and not the end of the revolution itself. Now, there is vitally important experience and crucial lessons from the experience of the socialist revolution and socialist countries so far over the last century. The overwhelmingly positive accomplishments and lessons, but also very real shortcomings and mistakes, all of which we must draw from in the broadest and deepest way in order to once again make revolution and bring into being this new society and do even better this time around. Now, obviously, I can't go through all the experience of these socialist revolutions and socialist societies over the whole past century in the time we have today. But what I do want to do is touch on what I think are some of the main lessons from this experience, particularly in terms of political rule in the new society. First, I want to talk about the question, which is controversial and important to get into, is why you need a state, why you need a dictatorship in the new socialist society, even though of a radically different kind. And here, when I use the term state, I'm not referring to just to the governing or the administering of society, but state in the sense that I'm using it, in the Marxist sense, refers specifically to a repressive apparatus consisting of courts and bureaucracies and, above all, special bodies of armed people, namely police and the armed forces. Now, in the socialist revolutions that have existed so far, particularly in the Soviet Union and China, there have been two profound problems that they faced in emerging into the world through the revolutions that brought them to power. And these two problems or challenges have been closely interconnected. One is that there are tremendous inequalities left over from the old society and from thousands of years of society divided into classes, into oppressors and oppressed. Inequalities between men and women. Inequalities between different nationalities. And very importantly, inequalities between what is called mental work and manual work. Between people who occupy their time working with ideas in a general sense and people who do manual work, mano, the hands, working with their hands and their back. This is a profound division that's existed in society for thousands of years ever since it emerged in the form of class divisions and social inequalities thousands of years ago. And overcoming these inequalities is going to be a process of profound struggle. It's proven to be, and we can see that it will be in the future. At the same time, these socialist countries don't emerge into the world isolated unto themselves. I was talking about this contradiction or problem facing the comrades in Nepal. Any revolution that actually succeeds will emerge into a world, at least for a certain period of time, in which imperialism is still dominant, in which there are powerful imperialist and reactionary states, heavily armed and extremely hostile toward this new revolutionary society. And the question of how to handle the struggle to overcome these inequalities while at the same time defending the revolution against attack and outright military invasion by imperialist powers poses a great challenge and has posed a great challenge. And one of the ways in which these two things become concentrated is in the fact that in the new society, you need an army. It would be very nice if we could make a revolution and just say, okay, that's the end of all violence. We've had enough violence, because a revolution will be violent. Because those in power, as we've been talking about here, are going to violently resist being ousted from power and having their whole basis of exploitation uprooted and ended. So it would be easy and tempting to say, well, okay, let's not have an army. Let's just do away with that and see what happens. Well, we know what would happen. Very quickly, everything that you'd fought to bring into being would be crushed and drowned in blood with a vengeance. Because not only would the old exploiters and oppressors want to get back power, but they would want to teach a lesson to people never to even think about doing this again. So you have to have an army. And there are also people within the new society itself who are the beneficiaries. I'm not just talking about people who had a little bit better lifestyle than others. I'm talking about people who rule the system and people who worked for them in a systematic way, who are going to oppose everything you're trying to do in the new society and are going to organize armed violence to oppose it and sabotage. They're not going to sit around and say, well, let's see how you do it building a new economy. Let's see if you can actually do a good job of meeting the needs of the people. They're going to blow things up. They're going to try to destroy things, just like the U.S. did in Nicaragua. You're going to have to be able to meet that threat. So you're going to need an army. But having an army is a contradiction, and a very profound one. You can't do without it, but it causes problems to have it. And this is something we're going to need to work through better the next time around. Because what happens is an army, even if it's a revolutionary army, like the People's Army in China, which had a long tradition of being drawn from the people, closely integrated with the people, carrying on political work with the people, It didn't have all this stupid stuff they have and reactionary stuff they have in armies like the U.S. No saluting and yes-siring of officers. No fruit salad all over the uniforms of the officers. Had very close unity between officers and the rank and file of the army. Nevertheless, an army, by definition, is a professional body of armed people whose full-time profession is becoming proficient and expert and trained and skilled in military affairs. And when you have a body of people like that, who that's their full-time profession, and they are equipped and trained to be able to do that, that poses a sharp contradiction with the populace as a whole. Even if that populace were to be organized into people's militias, as they were in the Soviet Union on a much bigger, deeper scale in China, if you have a group of people who comes to power, even from within the new state or the new party leading that state, who want to go back to the old way as happened in China, if they use the existing apparatus of governance and of the state, and in particular the army, they can crush the resistance of people who want to keep the revolution going. This concretely happened in China in 1976, shortly after Mao died. People who were aligned with Deng Xiaoping came to power. They've been fighting to take China back to a capitalist way, which they've now done. Once Mao was out of the way, they made their move. A lot of them were veterans of the revolution for decades. They had the respect of commanders in the army. They called out the army to suppress resistance of people who wanted to keep going on the socialist road and didn't want to have this coup put an end to socialism and bring back capitalism. I remember when this happened in China in the fall of 1976, I was at home listening to the radio. And they played this broadcast, and this was before satellite TV and all that. They played this broadcast of a reporter in Shanghai, the largest city in China, announcing as a battle was going on between the people's militia in Shanghai resisting the army coming in to put down the rebellion to try to save socialism in China. And I'm going, come on, militia. But they actually had no choice, a chance. They were crushed within a couple of days because this special body of armed people was much more powerful. This is a major contradiction that we're going to have to work on and do better the next time around. You cannot do without the army. You can do many things to try to keep the army on a revolutionary road, but these contradictions will be with us. Now, I also want to talk to a point that Lenin made in the early years of the Soviet Union. He said in a rather provocative way that this new form of rule, representing the masses of formerly exploited people, the dictatorship of the proletariat, he described this as being like the bourgeois state without the bourgeoisie. Now, what did he mean by that? Like the capitalist state without the capitalist class. Well, what he meant was, it goes back to my point earlier about these inequalities that are left over. You cannot sweep away all these inequalities at one fell swoop. You have to work over a whole period to undermine and transform the foundation for these inequalities. But while you're doing that, ironically, you actually have to enforce certain inequalities. For example, certain people have to be paid more for certain occupations or jobs than other people do for other jobs. You cannot pay a physicist or a doctor the same amount as you pay a factory worker. Not just because physicists and doctors are used to making more, but because there's a whole period of training and education that goes into becoming a doctor or a physicist. In other words, a great deal of society's labor is being put into that. And if you pay that the same amount as you pay someone doing a job that doesn't take the same amount of training and education, your economy will go out of whack. The amount of labor that you're spending will not be corresponding to what you're paying people, and the whole thing will come unraveled. Well, that's an acute contradiction right there. You can narrow these differences step by step, especially by raising the bottom levels up. But while it exists, you have to actually enforce inequality through the state. To be very concrete, let's say somebody's making less than a doctor, says, fuck that, and goes into the doctor's house and starts taking all the shit out of the doctor's house. Well, you can't allow that, or your whole society will come unraveled. And if you can't persuade them not to do it, you have to use the force of the state to prevent them from doing it. Or take another example of things you have to enforce with a new state. We aim to get to the point where things such as rape will be long distant in the past, and people will even have a hard time believing that one human being did that to another. But that's not going to happen immediately upon seizing power or just a few years into the new society. So what are you going to do? There are going to be people who are still going to be with the old mentality, still seeking to dominate in the old ways and oppress in the old ways. You have to use the state to prevent that. If persuasion doesn't work, you cannot allow people to rape until they're persuaded. You have to bring the force of the state, the laws, the police, the courts to bear to prevent that. And we should understand, all coercion is not bad. Coercion that prevents rape is not bad. Someone was commenting on the movie, Remember the Titans. Many of you may have seen it. It's about a football team in Virginia, a high school football team where the high school and then the football team was integrated. And someone pointed out, well, you know, they just presented this to these students and their parents. This is the way it is now. The school's going to be integrated. The football team was all white, is going to be integrated. And plus, the football coach is going to be black. Now, if they had gone, for example, to the white students and parents and said, well, what do you think? You want to have the school integrated? You want to have the football team integrated? You want to have a black coach? They would have been overwhelmingly told no. But on the basis of saying this is the way it's going to be, then they were able, as the movie portrays, to do work and struggle to win people over, and did win over most of the white students and many of the parents. So there was coercion there. They said this is the way it is. It's going to be integrated. When you have a new society, you're going to say this is the way it is. Certain things are not going to be allowed anymore. Discrimination is not going to be allowed. Violence in the form of rape or lynching is not going to be allowed. End of discussion. Then we can have struggle about winning people over from the outlook that would incline them toward those things over a period of time. But some things have to be a matter of law and a matter of enforcement by the state until we get rid of all these inequalities and all the ideas that go with them, and then we will no longer need this. In addition to needing a state, it is also true that you're going to need a leadership within this state, within this society. You're going to need a party at the core of this, a vanguard to lead all this. Why? Because immediately all these inequalities that I've spoken about are not going to be overcome. Not everyone who takes part in a revolution is going to have a fully developed understanding of where that all needs to go. There is going to be unevenness. This is part of the deal. It's something we have to learn from the experience of socialist revolutions. When the revolution happened in Russia, for example, in October of 1917, all the other parties that were trying to, in some way or another, oppose the regime as it existed, all the reformist parties, even those who adopted the title or name of socialism, all of them at a certain point in the midst of World War I and with a great crisis in Russia, all of them found themselves unable to lead a way out of this. And only the Bolshevik Party was willing to lead people out of this. And so masses of people swung over to support for the Bolsheviks. And they carried out the revolution and then won a civil war over several years to consolidate that. But one of the things that's important to learn from history is that there's a difference between people uniting with you in an acute crisis like that to forge a way immediately out of terrible conditions, and people being fully won over to the full vision and program that you represent and that, in fact, society needs to take up. And if you confuse that, you'll make very serious errors. To use it to sort of illustrate this graphically, you could sort of see, like, here's a society with broad diversity. At a point of a revolutionary crisis, everything comes together in a very concentrated way. But then after that, it's going to broaden out again. The diversity of opinions, the unevenness among people, the inequalities among people are going to reassert themselves. And so you're going to need a party to lead this whole process through so that you don't try to simply impose every change on people on the one hand. And on the other hand, people are mobilized, led, and consciously unleashed to make transformations wave after wave. Now, to get at this, I want to tell a story about a very interesting conversation I had with a poet and spoken word artist recently. I was talking to him particularly about the arts and how we would try to handle this under socialist society and the positive experience and some of the problems I saw from previous socialist societies. And I said to him, well, you know, you write poetry. And we all recognize there's a great value to cooperative efforts. You know, you work together with people on projects. That's very good. And you get criticism from other people of your poetry. And that's very valuable. But I said to him, you know, it doesn't seem to me that you could write your poetry collectively. You know, at a certain point, you're just going to have to go off and write your poetry. And people can try to, you know, persuade you and influence you about what it ought to be about or how you ought to do it. But you're going to have to take off and do it yourself. And otherwise, there's not really going to be a creative process. And many new things that might add to the richness of society and even the richness of the struggle to transform society won't come forward if that doesn't happen. So we went back and forth on this, and he was getting more and more the point I was trying to bring out. And he said, it sounds to me like what you're talking about is a solid core with a lot of elasticity. Because you're talking about how you need leadership, but people have to be taking a lot of initiative, and there has to be a lot of creativity, and a lot of ferment and wrangling about all these things in the arts and other spheres. So it sounds like to me like what you're talking about is a solid core with a lot of elasticity. And I said, you know, that's very good. Because it did capture what I was trying to wrestle with and get at. And I think this applies not just in the arts, but generally to how a social society has to unfold. You need a core of people who see to the farthest horizon and where the struggle needs to go, and who are determined to lead things to go in that direction and to not let power be taken back over by the old exploiters or new ones arising in new conditions. But you also need a great deal of diversity, of wrangling, of intellectual ferment, of diversity, of creativity, of critical thinking, of trying out different forms of art and literature and seeing where they lead or if they lead to a dead end. And if you don't have that, your society won't be vibrant, it won't be living, and it won't continue forward transforming and overcoming inequalities and advancing to a classless society, which is our ultimate goal. As I thought about this more, it seems to me that the challenge for that leading core, that solid core, could be put this way. It's a question of preserving power while at the same time making that power something worth preserving. And that's the real challenge. And more specifically, I think there are four tasks or objectives for a solid core like this. One is, yes, to hold on to power and not let the old exploiters or new ones destroy the revolution and drag people back to the horror of the past. Two is to be working to constantly expand that core so that more and more of the people in society are becoming part of the leadership and the decision-making process. Three is to constantly have in view and be consciously working toward the eventual abolition, the ending of the need for any core like that, as more and more people through the whole back and forth and twisting and turning process of the revolution are drawn into consciously administering and transforming society. And four is at every stage, while hanging on to that core, maintaining that core, seeing that there's the greatest possible elasticity at the same time, the greatest possible diversity, dissent, creative thinking, intellectual ferment, and so on, so that your society through all of this will be greatly enriched and the best possible synthesis of the way forward can be brought forth out of all this wrangling and upheaval even, and not perceiving this as some sort of straightforward march led by the same few people. And this is the kind of process that, as I see it, is going to be necessary in order to advance, once power has been seized, to a point where the things that I've talked about that are necessary in the early stages of the revolution, of the new society, the state, the courts, the police, a certain amount of coercion, and yes, a leading role of the most conscious core, become increasingly unnecessary and finally can be done away with. This is a challenge that we'll face.